deathly silence now while I find this line. Can't get anything to happen. Switched itself on. I got the password. Well, while she's looking for that, I can at least start with my thanks, can't I? So, I really am so pleased to be invited here, not least because I did write that one paper with Caroline Oliver using Bourdieu and haven't really used Bourdieu otherwise, so don't, well, until more recently, but haven't really put myself in any sort of category as a Bourdieu expert or anything, so to be invited to come along here is absolutely great, and so lovely to see so many people, and I'm looking forward to the day once I can relax and switch off. So if anyone wants to see the slides, I'm happy to circulate them afterwards. I tend to write my notes on my slides, so I don't hand them out straight away because I have time to cut out all my silly nonsense. What I'm going to do, I'm going to kind of remind everyone, not assuming everyone has read the paper, what the paper with Caroline is about. So I'll spend about half my time doing that. And then I'm going to move on and talk about what I've been doing more recently using Giddens' work and Bourdieu and other people to come up with this notion of writing practice stories about migration. And because I was on the BSA Council, I'm used to that. I'm used to having to ignore that. So the paper was published in 2009 with Caroline Oliver, and she's just had a baby, so she couldn't be here today. This photograph was taken with permission of a father and daughter getting ready for the ferrier, and I particularly love it because he's covered in tattoos and his shorts and got his beer in his hand, and she's got her ferrier dress on, the best she could afford, actually. The paper was written based on ethnographic research that I had done for my PhD, 93, 95, and then updated 10 years later. And in the meantime, somewhere around then, I can't remember, Caroline had also done research in a different part of the Costa del Sol. So we'd both researched British people living in Spain, and we'd both written about it separately, but never written anything together. So this is us bringing our work together. In those intervening years, we've started to talk about these kind of migrants, as Mikola Benson and I have started to talk about these kinds of migrants as lifestyle migrants, because over the decades, actually, the last couple of decades, it's become increasingly obvious that people are moving from fairly wealthy areas to relatively poorer areas and don't fit it neatly into any other migration categories like labour migrants, economic migrants. And what they're seeking, above all else, is something they very loosely define as quality of life, and moving somewhere relatively cheaper, but more than that, to places that kind of suggest and offer for them certain things they seek for in terms of quality of life. And these could be very much seen as sort of individual self-realisation projects. And they can very easily be understood using the work of social theorists like Giddens and Beck and Bauman. And I had done that. And I'd written papers about how these people who had very often later in life, very often retired. In Caroline's case, she was studying retired migrants only. So both of us talked about people who were sort of severed from their work commitments, from family ties, and found themselves free to sort of create their own futures and do what they wanted with their lives. And that's how they talk as well. So it's sort of faithful to the phenomenology that they talk about, you know, being free to be able to leave their families behind, leave their pasts behind, start a whole new life. And they often talk about this, and lifestyle migrants generally often talk about this as if they're being true to themselves. They can finally live the life that's true to how that, you know, the values that they think are important and that are true to themselves. So we both use these kinds of theories to understand this migration, but we both felt a bit uncomfortable about it as well, because it worked, but we thought actually we're focusing far too much here on agency and free will, and we know when we actually speak to these people that they're not so free-floating as these theories would like to portray. And not only that, the more we spoke to each other, the class dimensions of these migrations really came to the foreground. So that's what the paper that we wrote together really talks about in much more depth. So we found for this paper that Bourdieu offered much more for us in terms of various different concepts. You can't see that, I want to draw, it says fish out of water, and he's tipping up an empty jar. I just thought that was lovely. And what's really nice, I don't have to stand here and teach any of you guys about Bourdieu, because I'm sure you all know more than I do, so I can sort of nicely, quickly skim over. The fact that the reason that we found Bourdieu useful was because, you know, we were able to talk about economic aspects of migration as well, and material aspects of migration, as well as the cultural aspects, and how these intertwine, and looking at social processes, and how these social processes take their shape over time. So what we started to look at, we used various of different Bourdieu's concepts, and some were much more useful than others, and they're the ones I've highlighted here. One thing we found really useful was this concept of social field. Now, I would love to have a discussion later with anybody about this, because I find that a very difficult concept in Bourdieu to understand what he means by it. But it was actually really useful for us, because with these migrants, the sort of communities and the setting that was relevant to them in their daily lives was the migrant community. So although they'd moved to a different place, they'd moved to Spain, actually in their daily lives, Spain wasn't all that, didn't feature all that much, other than somewhere that they were living and had certain food and people. But you know, many of these people were retired, or are retired, or they're self-employed, and if they're self-employed or you know, working on their own account, they're working with other British people. So their social field, the social field that was relevant to them, was this new migrant setting and mostly of other British people. So this was something that we spent much more time then looking at. And sort of then Bourdieu talks about how people struggle, that they, within a social field, there's competition for resources, and everyone learns to play the game, and they learn the rules of the game. And the struggle over resources are for of the various different capitals, of course, and the economic, material, and cultural resources. And what we noticed in Spain, that what people were struggling over was actually the right to be able to say and to claim to have achieved the good life and the good quality life, and to be able to say, you know, we really have left our past behind, and we really have shaped the future in this way. We live a lovely, peaceful life, and we live a good quality life. And so it was the ability, the rules of the game were about showing how you'd achieved quality of life, but also within that there were struggles over not only over who was able to do it better than others, but also who had the right to define what that was. So what got defined as, you know, the good life was also struggled over. And of course the concept of habitus was very important to me, and I just love these phrases because they are straight out of Bourdieu, and they sound as if I made them up. But he says things, and of course in translation, and I don't know what it would have said in the original, but in the translation there are phrases like the idea that yesterday's man predominates. And the lovely thing about using Bourdieu for migration is that you really have taken people have been taken out of the situation within which their habitus might not be something they reflect on and might not be challenged, so that they, you know, might feel very comfortable, and their norms and habits and rules might not be something they're very aware of, and their practices are just very very everyday and unconscious. And when you move somewhere else, you start to reflect on these things because you know you're confronted with with different communities, with different settings, different challenges, and, you know, in this case, different jobs, different, a whole different way of life. But of course, we also wanted to draw on this notion that, from Bourdieu, that habitus is transposable, it's not something fixed and unchangeable. So we particularly like that, and we particularly like that because that we noticed that the structure of social positions was being reproduced despite what people were saying. So despite the rhetoric, and that's one of the wonderful things I think about ethnography, is that you can listen to what people say but also look at what happens, and you can challenge a little bit over time what people are saying. So in terms of learning the rules of the game, in these settings, you know, you very quickly learn to say, oh, this is wonderful and we're having a fantastic time and, you know, everybody's very, very happy. And I've told a story from way back about a woman that I interviewed for about an hour and a half who told me how wonderful her life is. And I turned the tape recorder off and her friend came in the door and she said, oh, she said, are you ready now? We're going out, we get so bored here. And she just looked at me and her face just sort of fell. And I can still picture this face, and she sort of... And she said, well, yeah, well, we do sometimes get a bit bored. And my daughters came to Spain with me. And we went back to the UK for a little while, somewhere between the year. And they had a jolly good time going back to the UK. But they learned that they weren't supposed to say that. So when they went back to Spain, they were moaning to me, saying, Mom, I've been telling my friends, you know, we did this, we did that in Britain. And no one will let us. They keep telling us, yeah, but it rained all the time, didn't it? And it's just grey, isn't it? And didn't you just have to stay indoors all the time? Yes. So you become very aware of these rules of the game, of, you know, talking about how good life is in Spain. So in terms of the rhetoric then, very much people are saying things like, it doesn't matter what you were in the past, this is somewhere to start a whole new life, to begin again, you can be who you want to, and they, you know, these are real quotes, you can be who you want to, you can start again, it doesn't matter who you were. The culture was often quite anti-materialistic as well. I mean, I've had colleagues who've said to me, oh, you know, British and Spain, it must be really interesting to study how they use Botox and things and try to look like the Marbella babes. They're not really doing that. Or it must be interesting to look at luxury and things like that. They're not really, it's not really about luxury, and it's about enjoying a fairly simple life, about downsizing and simplicity. They're seeking a slow, quality, tranquil life. And they do kind of, you know, have fairly loose family ties because they have moved away, and the time has come in their lives when they've been able to move away. This is actually quite problematic. I've written a whole chapter about how women would tell me quietly and secretly that actually they really badly miss their grandchildren and wish they could go home and things like that. So, you know, this is very much the rhetoric about making a fresh start, leaving your past behind. And, you know, if you're going to mention that you miss your family, you should do it quietly. And I got told off more than once for trying to have a serious conversation. You know, and got told things like, people are on holiday here, you're not supposed to... Getting a bit heavy, Karen. And of course, I was a left-wing feminist as far as anyone was concerned. And here's a quote from Caroline's respondents. Somebody said, you know, your dinner service doesn't matter a damn here, which kind of means, you know, what you've brought with you doesn't matter. And a guy in a club, clubs and societies are huge, a guy in a society who'd been a major in the army and tried to use that to get himself a high status in an association very much upset everybody, because it doesn't matter that he was a major and he shouldn't be using that title. However, you know, that's the rhetoric, and however, there was an awful lot going on out under the surface, and we teased this out in conversations, Caroline and I, and it was really great to have someone to share that with. I recommend that, working with somebody else, because you sort of bring things out that you had sort of overlooked, perhaps. One thing that's glaringly obvious when we talk to each other was, as Bourdieu says, that different groups have different amounts of capital with which to appropriate social space. and he says they are able to bring closer desirable persons and things, which you can see that in social in actual material space, how people do that. And the two places Caroline and I studied, this is really obvious. Caroline studied, well, she's changed the name, so I better do that as well. But in the Western Costa del Sol, which is much less developed, and she went to a small village which had originally been settled in terms of migrants by fairly wealthy elite artists and designers and things like that. And so then the migration had followed on from that trend, whereas I did my research in the Costa del Sol, where tourism had led to second home ownership to settlement. So the Western Costa epitomises, sorry, Caroline did hers in the East. The Western Costa epitomises mass tourism, and the Eastern Costa has retained its traditional flavour. And I picked these photographs. It's not the best photograph I could find, but I really wanted to get the village she did her research in, but then if you knew it, you'd know what it was. But, you know, where I did my research, you could walk down the street and there were masses of British bars and also some German ones. And you know, you can buy pie and chips, and you'll see bars advertising the football and EastEnders, and it's for tourists as well as for migrants. And you're talking massive great tower blocks right up to the frontage. And where Caroline did her research, also where British had settled, little white village, one or two maybe British establishments, but they're very low key. So straight away, social space mapped onto physical space. So that's the first thing that we wanted to talk about. Then we didn't want to simply take a cultural approach using Bourdieu and say it's all, you know, social class is all cultural. Because, you know, you couldn't deny the fact that there were economic distinctions between these different groups. And I don't just mean between Caroline's and mine, but within the groups as well. Some people had retired and were living off their pensions, and some people had big pensions, and some people had very small pensions. In terms of home ownership, some people were owning and some people rented. Some of those who rented were in very tiny little places, and some people were living in caravans. And that's somewhere I'd love to do the next piece of research, because there were people who lived in little sites, all sites just full of little caravans. And because they wanted a piece of this good life, but that's the best way they could afford that. There were different, in what Bourdieu would talk about, ostentatious displays of economic capital. So some people only had enough money, you know, to get by, really. And therefore, they still needed to sell their labour. So although we couldn't really class these people using an economic classification, because they'd left their jobs behind, they were often retired, or they'd started new types of work, it was very difficult, it would be very difficult to classify them using an economic classification. Nevertheless, you know, some were selling the labour, some were buying labour. Some were buying labour of Spanish people, so they would have a Spanish maid or a Spanish gardener. And some was buying the labour of British people. You know, they would have a British man to clean the pool, or they would have a British man perhaps doing the gardening, a bit of building, things like that. And one story that's in the book, it came from my research, so I can tell you, because I was there and I can still hear this being said. There was a guy, a gay couple, and the one man, he owned a great big estate agency in the UK and was very wealthy. And they employed lots and lots of people, British people, to do all sorts of things, you know, build the house and look after the garden and look after the pool and do a bit of paint, masses of things. And his partner was working class, so working class, and he did people's nails. So he earned a little bit of money doing people's nails. And it was so interesting the way people would say, oh, you know, and I can't remember the pseudonym now, only the real name, so I'll just have to make up a name, Tom. So, you know, Tom's okay, he knows how to treat people, and I don't mind working for him. But, you know, Jim, he's just a jumped up little rent boy. He's got no... And so they decided, you know, that this rich guy was entitled to tell them what to do, but the poorer guy wasn't entitled to tell them what to do. It's really interesting. So these things start to, you know, you start to see that there are these distinctions. The way people enjoy the good life, you know, the trips they can go on, the outings they can go on, types of things they can do. And then something that has sort of maybe fairly incensed over the years, this notion of flexible mobility. We could describe these people as living incredibly flexible, mobile lives, and as mobile citizens, free from traditional ties and able to come backwards and forwards. And there were people like that. I mean, I met somebody who 2 weeks in the UK, 3 weeks in Dubai, a couple of weeks in Spain. But there are others who'd sold everything they had to buy their little house in Spain, and that was it. And in terms of, you know, the financial crisis, the very wealthy, or even the fairly wealthy, have been able to stay, and the very poor have been unable to leave, and those in the middle have gone home, you know, if they could afford to. So when it comes to something like that, these distinctions become very, very real. And then it became more and more obvious in terms of when you start to look at the building of social capital and of cultural capital. And here, very often, people's habituses are becoming relevant, not just in terms of the habits and norms and practices they bring with them, but also in terms of how, when they become a fish out of water in these new settings, they become much more aware of the sort of this consciousness of who they are and what they are, and also the discomfort that comes with not being able to place other people. So there is a lot of, in the building of social capital, which is incredibly important, of course, in terms of actually being able to transform your capital into something useful, you need to build social capital. Sorry, this should be down here on the next line, it's got a bit muddled up, but so there are all sorts of things like cultural capital displays, people talking about their tastes, talking about, so they established a fine arts society, for example, and a bowls club, and then there was a theatre group. So that sort of attempts to display cultural capital like that. And then, of course, there are the pubs and people saying things like, you know, I never ever go to those pubs, I never ever go to that area, and those people are just so, they talk about people that they had to avoid, and one thing that really seemed to concern people was this notion that it didn't matter who you were in the past, so there was this real tension between the rhetoric and actually trying to cope with, you know, people's habitus. It doesn't just go away. And the attempts to build social capital and building it on what you think you know about people. And people would really get quite tense about the fact, well, you know, I wanted to make friends with that person, but you don't know who they are, you don't know anything about them, they can just make up who they are, they can tell you anything. And this is where the EasyJet builders comes in. So you often heard about people who, when they got on the plane, they weren't a builder, and when they got off the plane, they were a builder. So they were called. So you must have heard about the EasyJet builders. So how can you possibly trust? So this, you know, in social capital really depends heavily on trust, and this trust comes from thinking you know certain groups. And the Dr. Jude reference comes from Caroline's work, because this, a woman she spoke to told her that very strongly your past doesn't matter at all, and she told her in a very strong Scouse accent that your past doesn't matter at all, and then went on radio and spoke and referred to her Cambridge degree and how she used to work in Cambridge, and her accent changed completely and she called herself Dr. Jude. So, and I just like this quote from someone. They live out here with no visible means of support. They don't work. They're sponges. Terrible. They have kids who are 4 to 5 years old, which must be just stuck in time, obviously, filthy, with their heads shaved. In the village, they have a fiesta where the swimming pool is opened, and this lot get the bus down. They're filthy, dirty, and they drink all the free booze. They come out of the woodwork. They run around with their free-range children. And that was not a one-off. That was, you know... So, I'll read this bit because I find it easier to read. To conclude, using Bourdieu, we demonstrate the ways in which class nevertheless remains contested. and ultimately economic position is reinforced through cultural processes. There is a material reality that structures the extent to which people can live in Spain, and the manner in which they live, and whether they can stay there. On one hand, people seem in a good position to reinvent themselves, because occupational position, you know, lacks its discriminatory power once they've moved, and many people are much better off economically than they were in the UK. But then the symbolic becomes really, really important. Taste, education, other expressions of cultural capital are redrawn, and class judgments are employed to militate against others, the wrong sort of Brit, the chancers, those who watch Sky TV rather than pursuing fine arts. And class can, and also another thing that I didn't really mention much, that class is, of course, is also used by those condemning other people for being higher in the hierarchy as well, of course. So, you know, oh, they're just snobs, and oh, they're just post-colonials, or they want to use it. So it's quite interesting, and there is a lot of, as I think that quote illustrates, a lot of symbolic violence going on. Now, deep breath, complete change of tack. So I kind of look back now and I think, oh God, I've gone through my career, and I was, and it was all agency, and I felt frustrated with that. And then I got into Bordeaux, and it became rather that paper was a bit deterministic. It was kind of, yeah. So the structures just got reproduced, and so I still felt unsatisfied. And I think something about ethnography that makes you dissatisfied with going either way like that, because you're there with people over time, and you see. You know, you see things being reproduced, but you see things being changed, and I wanted to somehow get hold of these processes. So, plug for the book. Year before last, I published a book called International Migration and Social Theory, which was ostensibly a kind of overview of various theories used in migration, but theories used in migration are a bit weird, really, because they're on one hand, they're social theories, so they're theories used anywhere, or they're kind of concepts used rather than theories. We don't really have theories of migration, and I'm not sure we would want to, in all honesty. So I ended up working on social theories to understand processes, which wouldn't necessarily only be relevant for migration, but would be relevant for social processes. And I came up with the notion of telling practice stories, and I'm now trying to kind of claim that ethnographers working together, so, you know, practice stories benefit from teamwork or collaborative work, so ethnographers working together, done work over a long period of time, can bring, and not just ethnographers, you know, other people working in related fields, can bring their work together and can therefore start to tell stories about processes that will acknowledge structures, will acknowledge agency, but will also really work at trying to understand their interaction and their outcomes in terms of reproduction and in terms of new social shapes. And it's not something you can easily do all on your own, but I think it is something that I felt strongly about as well, because there's so much more being written now in social science. There's a massive proliferation of articles and works in many fields. And I worry that people aren't talking to each other as much as they should and putting their work together and saying, what do we now know? You know, everybody's trying to make a career for themselves or a voice for themselves. So that was partly driving it as well. So the notion of practice stories is a methodology based on an ontology, which I'll unpack in a minute. It uses a set of concepts that I'll also talk about. The key aspect that we really need to work at is the meso level. And the idea is to recognise, and that's why I call it stories, the sort of narrative, provisional, creative nature of social science and social life. So I pulled on various different theorists for this. Ira J. Cohen, who wrote a book called Structuration Theory, and talks about Giddens' work in structuration. I really like that quote, because this is what I'm trying to get at, this notion that all social life is generated in and through social praxis, where social praxis is defined to include the nature, conditions, and consequences of historically and spatio-temporally situated activities and interactions produced through the agency of social actions. That says it all, doesn't it? It's just all there in that lovely little quote. So this is just repetition of what I've just said, really. It's just an idea is to try to get hold of how structures are reproduced and changed over time and what's going on. But to think, okay, we kind of know that at a theoretical level, but we're not so good at doing that at an empirical level. You know all this stuff, so I can just kind of flip through this very quickly. I've written here, the history of hitherto all existing sociologies is the history of the struggle over agency and structure. We've kind of, you know, had this history, you know, that the early sociologists wanted to mark out social structures as independent, de facto, objective structure. And we know why they did that. They wanted to establish the science of society. They wanted to draw attention to something, you know, something that we wouldn't want to discard that, would we? You know, that was hugely important work. And then we had this massive shift. So, but you've forgotten about the free will. And various different philosophical approaches that enabled us to understand people's actions and choices and meet what they mean within their communities and how they understand what they're doing. And I think in lots and lots of areas of social science, we're now trying to find language with which to move on from that dualism. And I think a lot of the work that's going on is doing that. Now, here's an interesting thing. I went back to Giddens. So rather than only focusing on Giddens' work where he talks about reflexive individuals and seems... I get incredibly puzzled about Giddens because he can be interpreted as being incredibly... an action focused, but he can also be interpreted as being too structuralist. And of course, you know, he wrote three books only to set out this was the structuralist position, this was the more subjectivist position, and here's structuration theory. And the strange thing about structuration theory is that he defended it for a little while, and then late 1980s he abandoned it, joined New Labour, I guess, got on with other things. And it's been very difficult to do anything with it empirically, but I still think it was important work. And he said, what we know now, social theories have become too, and he's talking about the ontological nature of the social world, what is actually out there. And social theories, he says, have become too one-sided, subjectivist, too voluntaristic, objectivist, reify the social. We shouldn't single out economics, power, they're all relevant. The key thing was that he's saying that structure and agency exist as a duality, always co-made and making, so they're always intertwined, cannot be conceptually separated. Another important thing he drew attention to that I like was his notion of practical and discursive consciousness, which is quite similar, and he admits it himself that his work is quite similar to Bourdieu's work in practice. The notion that we kind of get on with our lives and we know what the rules and the norms are, but we're not always aware. So we understand social structure in a practical way because of the way we behave and react. But we can also become aware of it and we can reflect. And this is when we become reflexive individuals. Okay, hold that thought, because the problem with Giddens, of course, is doing anything with it. And when he did anything empirical himself, personally, I just couldn't understand the word of it because it just got so broad brush and so huge and sweeping. So bring in Bourdieu, and in many ways they're not that different to what they're ultimately trying to say. I really like the theory of practice and the logic of practice and the something of a theory of outline of a theory of practice. Thanks, Nicola. Yeah, I just want to say the theory of practice. Bourdieu, I think, is also trying, well, we know, he's also trying to deal with this tension between the objective and the subject. And he uses this notion of practice to say that it's through our practical relations with the world, and we're not always aware of it. We can be aware of it, but we go through life adapting to structures and adapting structures in the practice of our daily lives. And of course he has these important concepts like the habitus and embodied structures, and talks about how people are always in practical relations to the world, which, as I say, I don't think I need to go into much depth for you, because I want to, it's more important that I do the stuff that you might not have heard about. Then I found Rob Stones' strong structuration theory. Now, Rob Stones doesn't talk so much about Bourdieu as I do, and I think he could do with a bit more Bourdieu in his theory. But he's taken Giddens and some other people, and what he says is that he's tried to find ways to turn Giddens' work into something we can use empirically. And one thing that he says is really, really important is that although we might accept that structure and agency are ontologically intermingled, in order to actually do any research, we have to conceptually separate them. Otherwise, we can't talk, we can't, and I found this anyway with my book when I was trying to tell practice stories, that you keep tripping over yourself because you describe structures that, of course, have been shaped by individuals, and that while you're describing them, they're changing. You have to say where they come from, and of course, you know, the habitus is shaped by the structure, but of course, the habitus is shaped by the structure. It's very difficult. So he separates out the four parts of the structuration cycle, which I'll show you in a minute. And he talks about, so they're very important aspects of the work, is to be able to separate it out, to be able to talk about something as if at least at time minus one, these were the structures that were relevant for a given person or a given group of persons. So although those things, those structures were shaped by humans, they weren't necessarily shaped by those ones we're talking about. So for those ones we're talking about, they are hard, fixed structures. Like this building, of course, was built by people, but not by you guys. So we can start there, you know. So we're not saying that they're ontologically separate, but they're saying methodologically they're separate. And then he spends a lot of time talking about the meso level, which Bourdieu does want us to spend, of course he wants us to spend time talking about this practical level and practice of daily life. But he doesn't have very good concepts to help us do it, I don't think. And one, the position practice relations, I'm not so clear on what Stones means by that, but I'll talk about that again in a minute. One thing he talks about is, he talks about internal structures being separated into the habitus, and the habitus is the structures internalized. He has a kind of deterministic interpretation of Bourdieu, but I think that's understandable, because it often happens with a lot of people who interpret Bourdieu end up fairly deterministic in their understanding of the habitus. And then he develops some language with which to say, but he talks about conjuncturally specific internal structures, and here he's saying that people don't just relate in practical ways to their surroundings. But given that those surroundings are always changing, so we find ourselves in new situations, within new communities, within new groups, new rules, we're very good at very quickly readapting. So it's his way of sort of drawing attention to this kind of much more short scale, small scale, immediate kind of changes, which will eventually, of course, become part of the habitus. But at this time that we're, because we're separating times out, at this time, there's something that are more kind of intermediate and creative and have much more agency in them. So, reading again. So I've been reading Errol's work about Turkish and Kurdish women in the UK, and I think this is a really good example of the sorts of things that Rob Stones was trying to get at. Is it Errol? I don't know. Talks about how cultural practices and forms are understood, negotiated, and struggled over. So it's got a very dynamic approach to habitus and to capital. It's talking about Turkish and Kurdish women in the UK, skilled migrants. She talks about how this helps her avoid the how it helps her avoid the rucksack approach. And I think actually I started to think that we might think of habitus as a soup rather than a rucksack. You know, you have a big pot of soup. This is because my stepson's a chef. You might have a big pot of soup on the on the cooker. And you throw in an awful lot of stuff, and that makes the base of your soup. Well, that's your habitus. But, you know, over a day or two, it starts to boil down, you might have eaten some of it, and then you throw in some more bits, and it'll eventually change shape and taste slightly different, but the basis is exactly the same. So I think that the conjuncturally specific is the sort of new bits of peelings you're throwing in and changing it. I'm being a bit pushed. I thought I'd got five more minutes.
No? Yeah, about five.
About three, five. I'll be there, don't worry. Another concept that I found useful, Rob Stones talks about position practice relations, and I think he's talking about our relationships with other people within a field, and those other people aren't so much people as positions within a field. So our relationships with different positions within a field. So maybe our relationship with our mother, our relationship with our teacher, our relationship with our peers, and things like that. Well, I quite like Wenger's use of communities of practice. So again, thinking about how to understand this meso level, that mixed with this idea of situated learning, it makes you think about, so communities of practice are, I think, groups of people within whom we have to adjust, with whom we learn what the various rules and norms are for that group, and also the more hard, firm structures. And we each learn how to go on within these different various settings. So it's a much more creative approach than habitus might allow us to be. I also draw on Emma Beer and Misha's understanding of agency, because they separate agency into desire, which is hugely important for migrants, because you can't understand migrants only in terms of habitus, because where does the idea come from to do something completely different? So people have to be left with this ability to imagine something completely different. And of course, what they imagine and where that comes from is socially and culturally shaped, doesn't just come from nowhere. But they still, as agents, have to have that ability. And of course, it's made up of this practical consciousness, getting on through life and learning how to get on. Then finally, another thing I found useful was to distinguish very distant, broad structures, like huge structural shifts that we might summarize as individualization, or the mobilities turn and things like that, that really, you know, you and I are not shaping, but we are in our little tiny ways. From much more proximate social structures. So for migrants, things like social policies, and also things like getting your visa and negotiating with the local agent. So structures need to be sort of broken down as well. So I'm going to flip that bit, because that just breaks up the various things I've spoken about and shows you Rob Stones' cycle of structuration. So he's separating out, in order for us to be able to talk about these different levels over time, so as a process over time. I do think this is important, so I will just second or two on here. In terms of empirical research then, what we need to do is conceptualise, theorise, learn about structures from a distance, which involves survey work, documentary work, that kind of thing. We need to listen to knowledgeable individuals, because that's what we're talking about, people who do understand their lives. But also, they aren't always able to articulate their practical consciousness. So I find observation and critical analysis also really, really useful. And it is also essential to have a temporality written into the research. So where does that all leave us in terms of the British in Spain? Which is where I finish. Do you like that picture I saw there? That I started off talking about the British in Spain as a social field. And I never really said where that came from or how that happened. And I think what this different approach does is sort of take us back a step and forward a step. So it just broadens the horizons a little. So people like Giddens and Beck, and they are still important, because they help us understand these great big cultural shifts that gave people the idea that maybe they could live a different life and aspire to something different. And of course, there were more material shifts, like tourism development, that will give people the idea that. But when they did move to Spain, other structures were in place. For example, the Spanish call them residential tourists. They don't see them as migrants, they don't treat them as migrants, they have nothing in place to help them settle as migrants. They go as retired people or as self-employed people. They don't go with the intention to try to get jobs and mix within the Spanish economy. So that helps you understand, this broader perspective helps us understand why they're in this social field. It helps you understand, so they become retired or self-employed, they work in their own, because there's high unemployment in Spain, they're not going to try to compete in the Spanish job market. And of course they have language difficulties, because they're not working with Spanish people, and a lot of them are older and find learning a language difficult anyway. And they help each other out so much, and I think this could be very true of a lot of migrants, that they help each other out so much that it almost becomes this whole new emergent phenomenon comes of the migrant social space that's excluded by itself because they've helped each other so much and created this little bubble. So, final points. I do think it's best to use Bourdieu in the context of his whole work, and I think in our paper we overlooked the theory of practice a little bit and this kind of the sense of movement and change and new structures being formed. I think that Bourdieu can be used to be for political goals, to make a point, you know, class gets reproduced. I'm up front, I wanted to do that in that paper. We did have a political goal, you know. Actually, class is being reproduced here, and we wanted to draw attention to that. But we wouldn't want to do that too much, we're social scientists. And I do think other concepts can help us elaborate certain elements of Bourdieu's work. And I do think migration is a really good process, if you like, for drawing attention to things like disruption, process, agency. So this real sense of change and process that is in Bourdieu's work but is quite hard to bring out empirically.
She is actually here today, and if you haven't read the article, I would really recommend it. It's called Migrating Cultural Capital, and it's how to apply Bourdieu. I found it really interesting. So we're going to open up for questions now. Pauline.
I really enjoyed that. I really like that dynamic approach to how this has been developed. And I just wondered, what I didn't hear in that, it was almost like, as a researcher, you were a fly on the wall. And right. I was thinking particularly of what Bourdieu says.
I wasn't at all.
No. Particularly of what Bourdieu says in Weight of the World about the social location of research and how important it is, and the whole thing of how you would even get to discover what the... well, the differences, social differences are between people, you know, just that aspect of it.
Yeah. It's a really good point, and definitely I was not a fly on the wall, and it's not something I've written about, and I don't think it's anything Caroline Oliver has written about either. Am I right to say Caroline's middle class background?
Yeah, probably.
I think it's possible. Caroline Oliver's middle class background and I'm working class background. And you can't help wondering if somewhere along the line, you know, I chose the more working and spent more time with working class people and understood working class people more, and she spent more time understanding middle class people more. And it's definitely something that really needs exploring. I think it's now the richness now of us being able to bring that together. And it really would be really quite exciting
to examine that. I just say, just a quick, reading your paper, it's interesting from what you say of your background, because it seemed to me that as an academic, that came out more than your working class background, and I felt that your shared paper actually was much more about the elite, and didn't have as much as I would have liked about the the world views and the, you know, just how the lower class people in on the Costa del Sol legitimate their life and how they, it was more negative.
That's positive.
Like, God, it's so good here because we can go on the beach. And it just didn't seem, it seemed more positive for the middle
class. But whereas actually it was, I suppose, driven more by a political goal to say, look how these people are being denigrated and how terrible it is that they're being denigrated so badly. And look at this terrible language that's being used to you know, to put down something that, you know, is a really nice experience. So I suppose the problem is that you assume people know what's in other work, where you've talked so much about what a wonderful life, you know, that despite what people say about Brits in Spain, I always say, they're having a very good time, thank you very much, despite, you know, the problems that people keep unearthing about it. And it's revolutionary, you know. A lot of people's lives. Mm. So that, yeah, it's a really good point. Thanks for that.
Did you have your paper? No. Okay, so Bridget.
Yeah, I really enjoy your paper.
Thank you.
And I'm looking at migrants and minority communities in the UK, so it's quite interesting to kind of look at your thinking applied to British people in the same sort of situation but in another country, sort of inverted in a way, so it was very helpful to me. But I was interested, just as a bit of an aside really, that what exactly was the class discourse element of the people who didn't like the morality of the kids with the shaved heads, the feral kids? Were they feeling that those were undeserving poor, like lower working class? Were they middle class parents who were hippies? I didn't quite understand how that was a class discourse as opposed to a morality discourse.
Well, I think perhaps they come together sometimes, the morality discourse and the class discourse. So it's like, well, I read it as being that we are in a better position to decide what's moral and what's not. We are worthy of coming here because, I tell you one thing I didn't say enough, and it is in the paper and I was supposed to say it, that one thing that becomes, because the struggle over how to make the good life and how to be the good, and one thing that became struggled over was saying I'm integrated. So it became a very middle class, part of the middle class discourse to say that we integrate more. So not only that we're more cultural, but that we learn Spanish and we spend time with Spanish people and we understand Spanish culture. And so then linked to that was this kind of condemnation, not just of people who don't integrate, but people who, the wrong kind of Brits. So they would say that. It's like we have the worth, the right kind of worth to be entitled to be here, but they don't because they have the wrong values and morals. And I mean, I even had Spanish people say to me, you know, it used to be all right, but we've got the wrong kind of Brits here now. We've got the ones with the tattoos and drinking in the streets and things. So I think the moral and the class were linked together.
Yeah, I just couldn't understand which, if I was going to try to sort of say, well, that's a working class person, that's a middle class person, that's an upper class person, because there's plenty of people from, like, elite backgrounds who've dropped out, have tats and kids who are feral.
Yeah.
I didn't quite understand who was, you know, I didn't get that context. But
yeah, well, I have to be honest with you, that quote came from Caroline's work and neither do I completely either.
Okay.
And we could have chosen other quotes, which, I mean, I've got one in my mind where somebody said very similar to me, but thing to me, but it was more about how they're all single mothers. They come out here without their husbands, and they haven't got jobs, and you know they just go back to the UK and get their benefits and come back. So I think we were trying to get that kind of rhetoric, but I was also a little bit puzzled about the hippies, because I think they might be located in a slightly different place, mightn't they?
Yeah, yeah. I think that
because they can be issue. That can be quite a middle class choice to be a dropout, and can also be linked to being. Being quite close to the land and things. So, I agree with you about that. But you know, it's not that, you know, my first job was constructing the National Statistics Socioeconomic Classification, quantitative research on class. That was my first job after doing ethnography. And so I know what it's like, you know, trying to put people into boxes.
Yeah.
and so I just did not try to do that because it's you know, economically putting people into boxes is one thing, but then trying to put them into boxes and map culture and it can't be done. Bourdieu tried, didn't he, with his mapping of social space. And do you know anyone who uses a Bourdieu's in class scheme? It's just
the French do.
Sorry?
The census categories in France are based on a Bourdieu's.
In France, yeah. Well, yeah, they are and they aren't, because they've tried to, but yeah.
Hi, is it possible to ask two questions?
I don't know, how many other people want to ask a question at this point?
I can give one answer.
All right.
First one is related to your research, and I was wondering how the distinctions within the British immigrant relate to the distinctions within the Spanish society. I mean, whether there are links which are established along lines of class, for example, between the British immigrants and those and the Spanish people who are there. And the second one is more about the broader theory. And I was wondering what your thoughts are with respect to Archer's morphogenetic approach in order to understand the change relative to the reproduction of the social structures.
Right, the first one, it's really interesting because they are so, and I don't like this word integrated, but they are so not really part of Spanish society. And I mean, they are and they aren't. I mean, your children are going to school, going to Spanish school. People might have a Spanish cleaner or they've got a Spanish neighbour. But the relationship, you know, the structural position in Spanish society is very strange, perhaps like a lot of migrants. And so it's difficult to kind of to talk about class because they're almost existing on two different planes. But in terms of the relationship between them, something very strange happens. So going back to when I was telling you that one thing that's therefore deemed of value is to show that you integrate, then you can be integrated with your cleaner. You don't have to be integrated with the, you know, Spanish elite or Spanish middle classes. Just to be able to say that you know you went to the farrier with the man who looks after your horses can give you some symbolic capital. So that's quite interesting. And in the schools, it gets incredibly muddled in the school as well. Because I mean, I noticed my children went to Spanish school for a year, and one thing we noticed that we couldn't read class from each other. So the Spanish couldn't read British class, and we couldn't read Spanish class. We hadn't learned how to read those. And my kids made some friends with some Spanish kids, and it was quite a long while later, I thought, now I think about it, they were probably quite low in Spanish society in terms of this, do you know what I mean? I don't know, because we weren't trying to read it, and we weren't trying to do, so I'm wondering if, because there have been tensions between the Spanish and the British in schools. And Spanish teasing the children and quite racist comments sometimes about them because they're kind of all a bit friendly together. And then that gets a bit classed because the Brits can talk about them all as robbers and gypsies. And so there are some quite interesting things going on, but it's incredibly muddled.
So the values that are defined within certain circles are not the same.
I think so. Yeah, I think it's so set. Well, it isn't completely separate, but it when they're not fitting into the same social fields.
Yeah, that is valued.
It's the social fields, isn't it? That's when the social field concept becomes useful, I suppose. And in terms of Archer, yes, I need to read more. I don't know enough. That's okay. Honest. Yeah, I know it's on my list of jobs. I've had a couple of arguments with Dave Eldebass, who's in the room next door to me, who writes about
putting together. Yeah,
exactly. And he's told me that, you know, maybe you should think about that, because she as I understand it, she's kind of doing what Rob Soames is doing, and saying that we
separating
need to
conceptually.
So it might. But to be honest, I was writing a book about migration more than I was about social theory, so it's just only so much I can do. Yeah, it's a good point, thank you.
Any more questions? Bridget, you
think? Oh, well, I did briefly, I just to sort of expand a little bit on whether you think that Spanish society is open to the British to allow them to participate. I mean, one of the issues here is that migrants are kind of almost automatically in the working class, in the lower class in British society, and their opportunities to, you know, develop social networks are kind of are quite constricted. And I just wondered if that was actually mirrored in your experience.
I don't think it is, and I think and some of this is anecdotal because obviously I've got friends who live in Madrid and Barcelona, and that's a completely different experience. But I think where you've got mass migration like this, I think people get sort of clumped together and seen as a clump. And they are viewed by Spanish society as wealthy. Well, they're all wealthy, so they don't need us and they don't need any help. They're residential tourists, so the society actually, and I love that phrase, I didn't play with that so much, but they think that they're there on holiday and then they just stay longer. And it's kind of hit them really rather slowly that they've stayed, and then some of them are getting older and some of them have needs, and you know, and then I spoke to a policeman and he was saying that some of them get involved in crime and that they actually get social services involved and things. And it's kind of come as a bit of a shock because they have other migrants that they do worry about and do have concerns about and try to control. And they want to encourage this Western migration because they think of it as bringing in money, not problems. And then it came as a bit of a shock that it brings other things. And in terms of, you know, the cultural level, I didn't interview enough Spanish or talk to enough Spanish people to be able to tell you what they think. But from the British perspective, they would say things like, you know, because we're talking Andalusia, we're talking about places with quite long histories of families living in the area for centuries, and they said things like, you know, they're nice, and you know, they'll share their produce and things, and we'll talk to them, but they don't really want to know us. They've got their own families, and they're, you know. Why would you want to know the sort of stranger who doesn't speak enough Spanish? And so, yeah, and I think that's got something to do with this kind of mass sense of it being a mass, and perhaps not needing them.
I know.
Is there anyone else with a question? No, Pauline. I was just thinking about the assumptions when you're in Spain. The assumptions that researchers might know, just thinking about that again. And I was thinking particularly that, do you think you might have been looking, in a sense, for a reproduction of classes that you could see in Britain? And the reason I asked that is I wondered if migrants, lifestyle migrants, are actually more likely to be people who have dis-ease in Britain, that they are the people who are not comfortable in their social environment. So the habitus is not typical, is an oddity in a sense, that because they're uncomfortable, they're the ones who've migrated, and therefore whatever appears as a class system, maybe it's tempting to think that reproduces something in Britain, and maybe it's different, maybe the nuances are different.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, and it's not something I've thought about, you know, about, because it always begs the question, you know, whenever you theorise migration or try to understand migration, any theories you come up with don't explain why those people are not those people, ever, because, you know, there's various different cultural shifts, structural shifts, but not everybody migrates, so why do some and not others? And we don't really get to the bottom of that. So I like that as an idea. It's worth thinking about. But I think it actually happened the other way around, in as much as I wasn't thinking about class at all. Don't talk about class. Until Caroline and I got together and started talking more and said, you know, we've completely overlooked this. And I think it came up and bit us, and I think it actually also came up and bit the people who lived there. I think without them, I think maybe, you know, they definitely thought they were moving away from all that, definitely. Especially working class people thought we're moving away from all that. Perhaps not middle class people. Perhaps middle class people don't want to move away from all that. But certainly working class people did, and then it kind of just came back to them without them actually even choosing that. So yeah, the nice thoughts. Thanks.
Time for another question.
Yeah.
Hi, No? Okay, well, you've got 5 minutes extra now for a break.
So, see, I'm such a good timekeeper.
Thank you so much, Karen.